Hi there. Welcome to Crosstalk. I'm Corey Raven. I'm here with my co-host, Irene Lignos, and welcome. We have a wonderful guest, a friend of mine from my home group of a community of people all in recovery, and we really have a great time every time that we're together, help each other all the time. Irene, today we have Billy G here with us.
I'm so excited to meet him. You know, it's all going to be a surprise for me. I'm going to find out all about you, and we're going to hopefully get some good recovery stories.
We're going to do that. Bill, welcome.
Thank you.
So
glad to be here.
Billy, tell our viewers a little bit about where do you come from? How'd you grow up? What was that like?
Born and raised here in Florida, in Miramar. Born at Hollow Memorial Hospital, June 19, 1964. Grew up in a normal Irish family, six children, five boys, one girl. I'm the youngest.
I heard that Irish people don't drink.
There would be no AA if it wasn't for Irish people. We are the ones that got that going. But, you know, just a normal life. My wonderful parents, both alcoholic, but amazing people. My dad was a coach. He coached baseball, football, worked, ran home to coach the teams. Just type A personality, always going, phenomenal person. Had his first heart attack at 38 years old at the baseball field. Wow. He was 38, I think, when he had the heart attack. He was retired at 49, had a triple bypass surgery, and died at 67. But smoked two packs of cigarettes a day and drank scotch every day for the entire time. And my mom, same thing. They both drank alcohol. Everybody in my family. Four brothers and five. My oldest brother had Down syndrome, severe Down syndrome. Mm-hmm. So never lived with us from when he was a kid. He had to stay somewhere else. But the rest of us are all affected by this disease. All of us. Nobody escaped.
It should be said that just, I think, about a year, maybe a little bit more, your mom passed away.
Two years ago.
Thank you. And I remember that period of time, and boy, were you there for her.
Well, that's for me, that's a ninth step. You know, I was making living amends to her for, you know, many, many years in recovery, which I needed to, because I was a horrible son. I was a really shitty son. So it was important for me. So we grew up quick, South Florida in the 80s, which was a crazy time. Very early on, we got involved with it. We had a friend of ours that lived out west, and his dad was a pilot. And back then in West Miramar, there was nothing out there. It's just Everglades. Well, they had a landing strip by their house, and they would fly marijuana in from the Bahamas. And we met with him, and we met some of his friends, and we got involved in a smuggling operation. We smuggled a marijuana only from Colombia through the Bahamas into South Florida. 12 boats.
What was your job?
I worked surveillance, and I did offloading. So surveillance is along the route, once it got in the intercoastal to where the house was, I went along the streets as close as I could get. And the plan was, if they got stopped, that they would just pull to the side and jump off and get in the car and leave the boat, leave the pot, leave everything. That could all be replaced. The people could not be. So that was our job, was if something happened, they would come, jump in the car, and we'd take off.
Did that ever happen?
Close. We're at the mouth of the New River in Fort Lauderdale. One of the houses right by the, if you know Fort Lauderdale, right, the courthouse and the Broward County Jail is there. And our one of the houses was right past there. We'd pass the jail, we'd go up the New River, and a couple of the finger canals, and that was one of our houses. One day
those
they got
houses are beautiful.
Yeah, too. Yeah. We rented the house overnight. That's how we got caught. When we rented the houses, the DEA was working with the realtors. They said, any young people come in to rent houses, cash, let us know. Oh, and that's how they ended up catching us. But so, that day, he's right at the mouth of the New River. Marine Patrol was coming. So we had Coast Guard, Marine Patrol, and local police. So for a lot of police, Marine Patrol, or Coast Guard, that's who we look for.
So is it not like in the movies and shows where they're like dropping, you know, pillows or whatever you call them?
Bales.
Yeah. bales of marijuana or cocaine or whatever.
Now, the way it worked, the freighter would come. They'd set the freighter up, and you'd go out off Gun Cane to Bahamas. You'd meet the freighter.
Wow.
And back then, there was no GPSs. You had to meet coordinates on a map, and you would meet there at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they would offload the bales to us. We had what was called a shuttle, which was a 58-foot Hatteras. They would fill that, and then the Hatteras would come to us, the smaller boats. We had sailboats, power boats. Then they would offload to us, and then each of those boats would go into its specific house. We had houses from Boca to Miami. So that day, I was working surveillance, and there was a Marine patrol coming from the south, and my brother, who was a captain of one of the boats, was coming from the north. And we had codes for everything. There was a code for Marine patrol, a code for Coast Guard, a code for local cops, and they were named after fish. So the snooker biting, and that meant the Marine patrol were coming. And he had a choice to turn around, to come to the edge, and he didn't. He thought he could beat them to the cut. They met right at the mouth of the New River.
Ooh.
Right there. They stopped them. They stopped them. They went on the pier. They said, sit dead in the water. They commanded them, sit dead in the water. He stopped. They said, what's your port of embarkation? He gave them a fake address in Pompano Beach. They said, what's your destination? He gave them a fake address in Fort Lauderdale on the New River. And they put their foot onto his boat. So they had 1 foot on their boat and 1 foot on his boat. On his boat was 4,000 pounds of hash.
Holy
hashish, which was, we didn't normally do that, but this was a hash run.
This was a special.
And one of the other boats had broken down, so he had twice what he normally took. Normally took 2,000 pounds. He had 4,000 pounds.
That's crazy. How big was this boat?
It was a Duraback. It was 63 foot. It was a sailboat.
Oh, okay, all right, we're talking about.
The boats were specially painted. So the water lines were raised. So the painting was higher. So when the boat was sitting down in the water, it didn't look like it was sitting so low.
Oh, you guys were smart.
But it was sitting low. So all the water lines were raised. Names were raised. It was all done on purpose.
And who thought of that part?
We work for a large organization. I'll just say that. So I said, that's it. He's done. He's caught.
Wow.
And they asked him the questions. And brother stood right up there. And they said, okay. Took his foot back off. You can go.
Oh, we need to make a movie.
They had their foot on a 4,000 pounds of hash bus, and they let them drive away. We celebrated that night. Big celebration. Dom Perignon champagne.
Probably had snooker fishes.
It was a very close call. It was a very close call. But that, you know, that was, you know, we did that, you know, once a month, once every 2 months. We all worked. My sister and brother all lived in the house during the day. Fake. They didn't work. They'd get up every morning like they're going to work. They wouldn't. We'd go do whatever. They'd come home in the afternoon. And then when the house worked, they would leave and go to an apartment. And then the house would go to there and we'd offload. And that was how the operation worked. 1980, 79, 70, 81 right there.
But I understand that you did get caught. It wasn't that day.
No. I never got caught for any of that. When I was doing serious stuff, I was focused. When I got arrested, I was drunk and being crazy, which I tended to do.
So are we wrapping up that part of your life? Is there anything you want to share that we haven't gotten into with regard to that time?
I mean, that's what we did. We made a lot of money. We bought new cars. I bought a new car. I took it home. My dad said, whose car is that? I said, it's mine. He said, no, it's not. You don't have a job. You don't have a driver's license. I was 15 years old. It's in high school. It's a sophomore in high school.
Wow.
Driving a brand new car nicer than my dad's. He goes, who's good? He said, no. Get it out of my driveway. My dad was a straight shooter. He didn't. When we decided, so at some point they realized something was going on. Porsches, BMWs, boats, you know, they knew something was going on. So we took him to dinner and we said, you know, this is what we're doing. And my dad got up and said, did you think I was going to be proud that I raised a bunch of criminals? And he left the restaurant. I mean, and my mom said, be careful, you know, because that's what moms do. But, you know, they knew something was going on. And then I got clean shortly after. March 21st of 1986 is my clean date.
So you were getting high on your own supplies,
first of all, we only did marijuana. So I smoked marijuana every day from the time I was 10 years old till I stopped. That was the one constant. I didn't drink every day. I didn't do coke every day. I didn't do Quaaludes every day, but I smoked pot every single day. Wow. It was like a staple drug for me.
And you were in your 20s when you got sober?
21 when I got sober. So anyway, so I stopped at that point. I got arrested a couple times for trafficking in methaqualone, which was Quaaludes, which aren't around anymore, but Quaaludes were very popular them. Back then. They were everybody used to sell those on the side.
Notice I'm smiling.
I'm jealous.
I got arrested for a strong armed robbery, which was a wow. thing where we were out drunk and we took some coke off a guy, and he called the police, said we held him at gunpoint. Those charges were dropped. And then so I was on probation for the Quaalude charge. And I was out drinking, of course, on a date with a girl from high school that I knew. And I blacked out and I took her car and I got pulled over. And I didn't like the cop's attitude. It was a Davy cop. And he said, license, registration, which I had neither. And I took off and I ran. Mm. I got arrested that night for grand theft auto, attempted murder of a police officer, willful and wanton reckless driving, and a slew of other charges. Every traffic charge, you know, running red lights, all that kind of stuff. So I'd already been on probation, so I was on the no bond hold.
Once you're out on probation,
you get arrested, you can't bond out.
Once you're on probation, okay. Got
they me. Usually won't give you bond again because they've given you a chance and you messed up. So I didn't. So they held me.
As I understand it, that means that you're going to prison until such time as the case is disposed of. Yes, yeah. In which case, if you get assigned a prison sentence, then you stay there. And if not, if you're found not guilty, you go away.
Yeah,
go home.
You're at least held over till your court date, until you go to court on those charges.
I'm sure it's not like the next day.
No, it doesn't happen very quick. But I was lucky, and I was able to go into a long-term treatment center. I was released from jail to what was called a TC, a therapeutic community, which was called Spectrum Programs in Wilton Manors. And I went there instead of going, you know, got out of jail, was able to go there and was there via my pro. So I was court ordered to be there. Eventually, I got in trouble there and I fled.
AMA.
Because that's what I did, of course. They called it eloped the facility. I eloped because once you leave, you're kind of persona non grata. You can never come back, which wasn't my case. I became friends with the CEO, Bruce Hayden, knew him my whole sobriety. Incredible person. Went back to that place, spoke, was offered a seat on the board of directors of Spectrum Programs years later because I stayed clean, of course. But I still had the charges, and I had to go to court on those charges.
I'm so curious about something. I'm sorry.
Sorry.
You said that everybody in the family, all your siblings, were also active alcoholics or whatever substance use.
Yes.
Did any of the others follow your path?
No, I followed theirs. My brother Jimmy went to treatment first in a very similar way to me. He was taken in through TASC, Treatment Alternatives to Street Crime, and he went to a place in Miami called the Village South. And he was in treatment there about 18 months before I went into treatment. So he was clean 18 months when I went to Spectrum. My sister went into the SHARE program in Pembroke Pines about a year before I went in. So I had them as my kind of guideposts. Mm-hmm. I saw that it could work.
Are they still sober?
No. No, my brother Jimmy passed away, although he did die clean and sober, and my sister drinks. I'm the only one that did stay sober.
Can I ask how he passed?
When he was young, 16, he shared needles.
Oh,
and when he
shared
needles, he contracted hepatitis C. Back then, there was no real good treatment for hepatitis C. He took the treatment. The treatment almost killed him. And he was on the donor list at Jackson for a new liver when he passed away.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
So he died as a result.
How long ago was that?
He died 6 years ago.
Wow.
His funeral was unbelievable. There's hundreds of people there. Hundreds of people.
Let me guess, from the program.
People from his home group, people from his career. He ended up working at the Village. He was
well-known
in recovery in Miami. Yeah.
Literally, I mean, so not hundreds of people, but people who called and texted and sent flowers and gifts.
Yeah. It's amazing.
It's incredible.
So many people. The priest that did the ceremony said he'd never seen that chapel so full, ever.
Wow.
And all politicians, sports people, never as many as are there for
my
brother. It's amazing. So anyway, so I went to court. I want to tell a story real quick. When I went to court, I left Spectrum, so I was just kind of around. I was a fugitive because I wasn't allowed to leave there. So if I was to be pulled over, I would be arrested.
Mm-hmm.
So I was waiting for my court date. I had a public defender, and he said, bring your toothbrush, you're going to prison. I made a deal a year and a day, which was a good deal for the charges and my violation of probation, everything else I had. So when I went to court, I had my sponsor came with me, just like you just talked about. My parents were there, and my brother Jimmy was there. And my judge, Hinckley, was not there that day. To this day, I don't know what happened. I don't know if he had a sick day, but there's another judge. And the judge who was there that day was the same judge that sent my brother to the Village South instead of sending him back to prison. Mm-hmm. Jimmy, the one that passed, we were the most alike. When we drank and drug, we were off the chain.
And how old were you? Just a side note.
When I went to court, I was 20.
Okay.
20 years old.
I just want to get a picture of where we are.
Just because I wasn't clean yet. So I went to court. And the judge was there, and Jimmy came up with me. My brother stood next to me, and he said, "We're here to, you know," he did the allocution, which is you read all the things off. You're not going to get a trial. You know this. And my brother said, "Your Honor, I don't know if you remember me. My name's James Gilliland. I was here before you about 18 months ago. Instead of sending me back to prison, you sent me to go to the Village. I now work there. I'm clean and sober for 18 months. He was in a suit and tie. The last time that judge saw me, he was not in a suit and tie. He looked horrible. So he saw the change. And the judge actually got up from the dais and came down and shook my brother's hand. And he said, "It's nice to see someone coming back before me that I'm not sentencing to a long-term prison sentence. And I'm going to give your brother the same chance I gave you. He's not going to jail today. He's going home with his family." And I remember that the prosecutor jumped up and said, no, Your Honor, we've already made it. He took the plea deal. We already had, and the judge said, "Well, that's the nice thing about being a judge. I decide that." And I didn't go to prison that day. I went home with my family. And about 6 months later, I got, on March 21st of 86, I got clean. Got on my knees in my brother's house, my brother Michael, who was kind of the kingpin of what we did. And got on my knees and begged for help. I was still trying to get sober. I couldn't get sober. I was using. I was drinking. I was homeless. I was just a mess. My life was horrendous at that point.
Were you using intravenous drugs?
No, never shot dope. I was drinking, smoking pot, and getting coke. Anything I get my hands on. Tylenol, Secanols, Quaaludes. I liked that kind of stuff. I liked, but I was a garbage can. Anything, if you, you could give me something and say this, and I would take it. I wouldn't even ask.
I can relate.
PCP, TH, I mean, you know, acid, whatever. But that night I got on my knees and asked for help. And I woke up on March 21st of 1986 and something was different. I don't know what it was, but the obsession, the compulsion, the insanity that I felt in my, was gone. I have not felt that. And next month will be 39 years I've been clean and sober. And that was lifted from me that day. There's no question in my mind. Not to think I didn't still think about it, but I was not feeling that gut-wrenching, horrible obsession to use. I just didn't feel it anymore.
There may be people listening to you talk who are trying to make a change and haven't been able to figure out how to do that. I'm curious if you have any enlightenment on the subject of how it came from, you went from being active, being a garbage head, to getting on your knees. What preceded your getting on your knees? Any idea? Is it just divine intervention, or what was going on in your head?
Corey, I've been going to meetings. I'd been trying to get sober, and I was just sick and tired of being sick and tired. I didn't want to feel like that anymore. I felt like such a piece of shit. I just couldn't. I was either going to kill myself or I was going to stop drinking. That was it. I could not go on to where I was going. I just couldn't. And it all built up to that. Everything that happened every day prior to that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization finally caught up with me. I said, "I can't do this anymore." And I think it was divine intervention. There's no question. It was divine intervention. God saw fit to say, "You're done." You know, when they knock someone out and they do the, "He's out," God stood there and said, "He's out."
Wow.
He's done.
Put the hand up.
Wave the arms, counted to 10, count. "He's out. He's done." And that was it. And granted, I went to meetings. I got involved. I got right in the middle. I was young. I was 21. I took meetings in the care unit, Coal Springs, the adolescent unit, the Starting Place in Hollywood, which was for children. I spoke at schools, Cooper City High School.
So you spoke in a lot of different places. Why'd you do that?
Because I was asked. Anything I was asked, I did. back then, there was not a lot of young people in AA, and I was going to AA. It was a lot of 60, 70-year-old guys. It was a lot of elderly people, not even a lot of women, although there were, but it was mostly elderly men. And I remember saying, that night when I got on my knees, I said, I'll do whatever these old bastards say. I'm gonna give this 100%. Whatever they tell me to do, I'm gonna do. So anytime they told me, don't say no.
Right.
So I'm gonna ask you to speak, say yes. So I'm gonna ask you to go speak at a detox, say yes. So I'm gonna ask you to go speak at a high school, say yes. And that's what I did.
And you were in your 20s.
I was 21.
Well, I mean, when you got sober, but throughout your 20s, you were doing that.
Oh, I did.
Service.
Yeah. I worked the steps. I was, the program became the center point of my life. There was nothing else. I went to 7 meetings. I did not miss a night. It became, they told me this has to be the center point of your life. You have to make this number one or you're not going to get this. Mm. And you know, the nice thing about beating your head against the wall, feels so good when you finally stop. And I was able to stop. And once I stopped, you know, I had those alcoholic blinders on where, you know, I couldn't see anything except using. Mm. When I stopped, that came off. I realized that I was intelligent, that I was personable. I got a job in IT as a convicted felon, as a person that was unemployed and unemployable. I took a job as an IT tech.
Let me guess, someone in the program helped you get it.
How'd you guess? My mentor and closest friend in the world, Jared Robb, who's now passed away, gave me that shot. Yeah. Gave me that shot.
That's so what I love about this program is that, you know, people come in and there are so many people who have had years who have successful businesses. I mean, super wealthy. And then they're giving all these younger guys or people who need jobs a chance. And that's what's so cool is that there is life after using. You know,
well, it's because in recovery, we all know what it is we go through. And the people that are now in a position to be able to help other people, that's part of what our mission is mm-hmm. to give it away and try to help other people get
absolutely.
On their feet. And we get more than they get when we help other people.
Right.
That's why we're doing Crosstalk, right?
Mm-hmm. One of the reasons I don't give up on people is nobody gave up on me. They never gave up on me. As much of a train wreck as I was, they continued to try to help me. Always. Yeah. No one ever said, Billy, go away. Don't come back. This isn't for you. They said, please keep coming back.
Yeah.
You're going to get this. Just keep showing up.
Yeah.
So I took that job in IT. 6 years later, I was named vice president of IT for G Aircraft Engines. So 6 years from not knowing how to hit the enter key on a computer. I didn't know anything about
it. Oh my
God, when this guy took me in, I knew nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing. 6 years later, vice president of IT, stock options, 6-figure salary. And that was my life. That was my recovery. When I was sober for 9 months, I was doing my 4-step. My brothers got arrested. 2 that were remaining that were still using it, were still doing what we did, got arrested for trafficking in cocaine in Honolulu, Hawaii. It was front page in the newspaper. They still had the paper. Front page. The whole front page was diagrams of coke coming from Miami into Hawaii. And it was first story on the news that night in Honolulu, because they were sent, and that's what I did. I took the coke, flew it out. There was one of the things I did. So when I saw that happen, I saw that God was sending me a message. If you use, this is what's waiting for you. They say in the program, jails, institutions, and death. I already been to jail, I've already been in institutions. So that was all that was left. They went to prison for that. They went to prison on those charges, federal prison. I finished my 4-step. I stayed sober. I continued my recovery. And my whole recovery, messages have been sent from people, situations, business, whatever. We just had to be open to that. Open to those messages that are coming in from me, from God, guiding me in my recovery, you know?
You know, everybody, you know, when you see somebody, they immediately give you a thought in your brain that triggers. When I think of you, Irene, I think of beauty.
Isn't he so nice?
Collegiality.
This is why we're a silver tongue devil.
This is why we do this.
Well, anyway, there's a lot of other things I think of, and they're all good. But when I think of Billy, I think of someone that is so consistent. He is constantly giving people a message of hope. He lives the way he tells people to live. So do you ever get thrown off? Is it the times that you're taking the recycles out that you get thrown off? Or because every moment that I've known you, you've always been like so steady.
That's just fear, Corey. It's just fear. I'm fearful. This thing, this injury that I have creates fear in my life. It creates anxiety. Things I never had before. I was never fearful. I never had anxiety ever. I was in recovery for 31 years before I got hurt. So
the same thing that you were open to, when I speak for recovery purposes, I say, my name's Corey. I'm an addict and alcoholic. And my drug of choice is, what do you got?
Yeah,
exactly. And that's what I heard from you.
Yeah.
Well, but also, as open as you were on that side of it in recovery, I've heard all the different psychological things you've done in terms of meditation, program, EMDR. You kind of try everything. You're open to everything. And you also, you know, you let people know that all of these things are okay. You know, it's really inspiring. It's inspiring to know you and to see you every Saturday when we see each other, when I'm down here at least.
I have a sponsor named John Rogers. He says it. That's why I said it. If I use someone's last name, they're dead. But Johnny's still
now,
alive.
Now John may listen to this.
And I love that we laugh like that. Like,
it's true.
I've never tried to do an imitation of John, but I think I might. This might be the first time. Oh, my name is John Rogers. And today, so far, nobody's asked me to have a drink. And for that, I'm grateful. Something like that. I've totally botched it. But anyway, John's an amazing guy. Another steady rock.
I haven't had a drink yet today, and no one's offered. And for that, I'm grateful.
There you go.
But he says, keep it simple, keep it basic, keep it consistent. That's what he says. And I sponsor him. He's got a year more than me. He's 80 years old. I'm 60. And he's my sponsee. But we learn so much from our sponsees. It's not just from our sponsors. We learn. The next guy coming in here is one of my sponsees, Mike O, that's going to come true. Amazing story.
My sponsees during the last 2 weeks have probably helped me more than I'll ever help them.
You think that's why we say in order to keep it, you have to give it away?
Yes, I do.
Absolutely.
I really do. I think that helping people, like, it gets you out of your... it's just the most amazing thing to help someone else. Also, what do you guys think? Like, for me, when I watch that switch go off, right? And someone changes and they go from like hopeless, powerless, and just completely defeated. And then you see something light up in them and they're like, I want to do something today. Let me help. Let me do this. I feel good. I don't want to use. You know, I'm calling my parents. I have a relationship with them. Whatever it may be, I have my wife back, my kids back, whatever it is.
Yeah, I think the key is to compare how you felt when you were kind of at your bottom to how you feel a little bit further down the line, because that's what happens going forward. You've heard me say this before. You just compare how you felt when you started to where you are now, and it's always remarkably different and better. And you can lose sight of that on a day-to-day basis. But, you know, anybody who says, you know, when they walked into a treatment facility and they walked out, they didn't feel better, would shock me. You know, because everybody I know says, oh, I feel great. I'm running now. I'm exercising. I'm eating better.
Well, people who actually, you know, want, you know, there are many people that leave treatment and there's those bad reviews, like, it was the worst place ever. And then 5 years later, they get sober and they're like, you know what? Actually, I learned a lot there and I wish I did more. You know?
For me, one of the greatest gifts of the program is doing exactly what you just said, watching people, the light come on, watching their lives change, watch them get their families back, their wives back, their children. That's for me, that's the payoff. You just said, it's the greatest thing. And that's why we sponsor people.
Yeah. Getting a new job, working hard, feeling like they earned it.
It's an amazing, and to be able to be a part of that, saving lives is usually reserved for surgeons and doctors. And the guy that did my surgeries, I have a picture on my phone. I go back every year and meet with them and thank them for saving my life.
I love that.
Well, a little piece of that we do. We get a little piece of saving lives. You know, by the grace of God, next month, I will celebrate in my home group, which is Sunday morning, not Saturday morning. The DA meeting, which is a Sunday morning together group, for the 39th time. So, I've never missed. I celebrated my 1 year anniversary, and next month I'll celebrate my 39 in that meeting. That's consistency.
Amazing.
That's what Corey, that's what we do. That's how we stay sober. Be consistent.
So if you can go back to any age you choose and tell your younger self something, what would you say?
I'd go back and tell my 20-year-old self not to marry my first wife. That's what I would do. I'd go back and say, listen, you didn't want to do it? Run. Leave skid marks. Get away. That's what I would. Mm-hmm. That's honest.
So
that's
maybe
what I would do.
Persistence is not the answer in marriage.
I guess it depends.
You know what it is? Listen to your gut. Yeah. Listen to your gut.
Yeah.
Your gut tells you not to do it. Don't do it. Don't be, you're young. You know how it is when you're young. You're easily persuaded. Don't be so easily persuaded.
Right. That's good. Good answer. Billy, I am very, very grateful that you drove 6 hours to get here.
Not quite, but almost.
It felt like six hours. Thank you so much for being here.
I really
enjoyed the time together. I didn't think it could happen, but I got to know you a little bit better. I'm glad Irene got to get to know you.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you guys for having me. It's my pleasure.
And our listeners are now better off for knowing you. And I want to remind our listeners to smack that bell, follow, subscribe. Our followers are growing by leaps and bounds, and we thank you for that. Give us your comments. Let us know what we're doing that you like. Tell us what you want more of. And thanks for watching, and thanks for listening.
And if you think someone could benefit from it, share this with them. Yes. We want to help people. Yes. Comment, contact us. Our website has our info at. We answer our emails, so we're here for you.
If you're struggling, there is another way. There's another way to live, and if I can do it, you can do it. If we can do it, you can do it.
Yeah. That's
well said. True. Well said.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks. And we'll see you next time.